are fortunate to have a guest with us, Rod Whipple, who is from the National Conference for State Legislators, and he has a presentation for us on what is happening throughout the country with respect to state legislatures' role in the Job Training Partnership Act. So I'd like to welcome him and ask him to come forward this morning.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you, Senator, members of the committee. It's good to be in Oregon. You've been getting a lot of press back east. 2 weeks ago, your Razorback clams made the New York Times. I was fortunate enough to sample them last night. And also, last Sunday, the front page of the Washington Post had an article on your economic development programs. So people have been following what's been happening here in your state and your legislature quite a bit. We have two people in our Washington office at NCSL from Oregon, and they told me great things about the state, so I decided to spend the weekend here. It's my first trip, but it's good to be here. As you may know, NCSL is the official organization of all state legislatures, 7,500 in number. Our home office is in Denver. I happen to be in our Washington office, where I operate our job training technical assistance program. 2 years ago, we received a grant from the Department of Labor to get legislatures involved in the Job Training Partnership Act. This is the first time that NCSL has been involved in this area of policy. But there was a feeling on the part of the Department of Labor that it was important to get state legislatures involved. There are several reasons for that. The legislation itself gives specific mention to state legislatures. Section 126 in particular encourages state legislatures to be involved in job training issues. Now let me read that briefly if I could. Nothing in this act shall be interpreted to preclude enactment of state legislation providing for implementation consistent with the provisions of this act of the programs assisted under this act. There was a real feeling on the part of the Congress that state legislatures had a role to play in getting the Job Training Partnership Act up and running. Now, that's not so much as a state's rights issue as it is the realization that the training component of economic development programs is basically a state and local prerogative area. If the Job Training Partnership Act is to be made effective, it's going to affect a lot of other areas of your state policies, and policies which you as a legislature have major control over. Legislatures are responsible across the country for setting UI eligibility requirements and standards. They have a strong say over AFDC and public welfare policies. They have some say over economic development policies. They basically set education policy, and the key area of interest in legislatures across the country in the past 2 years has been in education policy, so we're finding out. And also, to the extent that you deal with the employment service in the states with your JTPA programs, Wagner-Peiser Act, Section 4, established in 1934, gave state legislatures specifically a role to play in how that program is established in the states. This is a long way of saying that if you want to affect job training policy in your legislature, your real effect on the program is going to come from what you do in these other associated areas of policy. And a little bit later, I'll go over whatever states have been doing on this area. This can be a problem for legislatures, because all these areas of policy are not necessarily overseen by any one committee in the state. And I will not name, but I can think of a few states where interlegislative committee disputes has had a problem in terms of the legislature setting some form of job training policy. But it's a long way of saying that job training policy is complex. It's social dimensions, education dimensions, and economic dimensions. If you have any questions, over the course of your session or in the future, feel free to give me a buzz, write for information. You should have a blue sheet in front of you that lists our program and the services we offer. We'll be doing some programs up in Seattle this summer in conjunction with the NCSL annual meeting. We also have a conference coming up in Charleston next month to look at the relationship of job training programs in the education system, specifically with respect to the way the training in those programs relates to state education standards. We suspect that there's a lot of training going on that's independent of the state education system in terms of standards. How do you assess the quality of your training programs? And also with respect to credentialing. In theory, a disadvantaged individual in a training program could participate in 3 to 4 different training modalities in the course of gaining access to an occupational preparation. How do you transfer what is learned in one setting to another? There's a lot of basic skills instruction going on right now in JTPA programs across the country. There's a lot of career preparation that's similar to other programs going on. How do you apply state standards to that? It's one of the things we're going to be looking at down in Charleston, which I understand at the end of March is a fairly good place to be if you have to look at issues like that. Job training policies, as I said, are difficult to get a handle on because they exist across a series of committees. But much to our surprise at NCSL, legislators around the country have been getting more actively involved than anyone anticipated. That activity is coming from education committees. It's not uncommon, as it was for me in Kansas 3 weeks ago, to meet to a joint meeting of the House Labor and Industries and Education Committees. We've done that.
I might say that would be rather easy in the Senate, since I chair both committees.
Okay. I can come back and do that. Other states are setting up their own individual committees to look at the programs. In front of you, you should find a chart that lists JTPA funding. Madam Chairman, can I assume that most committee members are
familiar? It has been distributed, I believe.
Okay. Yes,
so we should have it. We've got quite a stack of papers here, but I think people will find that document.
Okay. Most of legislative activity that deals with JTPA has been with the Title IIA programs, which are the core training dollars, and the Title III programs, which are for dislocated workers. Now, the Title III programs are recommended by the President for approximately $100 million cut in the coming session. Title II will basically stay the same. Again, this all the budget has to go through Congress, so it's subject to some debate. But the changes in Title II that may happen to your state will basically come from changes in formula and funding. As your employment rate goes up, your funding will go down. So that's one thing you may need to be aware of. The other thing is, of those Title IIA dollars that come into a state, 78% of those will go directly down to the local level. Okay? Each of you has an SDA in your district, or your district is made up of several SDAs. It has something called private industry councils in. Those private industry councils decide how the 78% of the dollars are to be spent. The Congress was very strong in feeling that for training purposes, you have to move close to the labor market area in which individuals live, and that people are best trained for jobs if there's a strong private sector involvement in the program. And so I suspect it's a good idea if every legislator becomes aware of who sits on the pick in their local district, find out who's getting funded for programs in the district, get a copy of the plans for your district. The law requires that each house of the legislature receive a copy of the PIC plan for review and comment. And in Kentucky, for example, the legislature is taking a very active review of those state plans, seeing what direction they're heading. The other area of involvement that legislation mentions for legislatures revolves around something called the State Job Training Coordinating Council. I understand in your state, 2 legislators, 1 representative of the House and the Senate, sit on that council. That council concerns itself with basic state administrative issues, and it also worries about the 22% box in that Title IIA. There are certain programs, set-asides, education coordination grants to coordinate the training system with the education system, the state council programs, older worker programs, 3% of those, the money's coming in the state to be spent on older workers, and something called performance incentive grants. And the state council advises the governor on how those programs are to operate. The performance incentive grants, I'll mention briefly, is actually in a very important part of the legislation that hasn't come to realization yet as the program gets set up. But a lot of people compare JTPA to CETA. It's not necessarily correct. The Job Training Partnership Act, for one, is a very different legal structure than the Compensatory Employment Training Act, its predecessor, was. The Job Training Partnership Act contains no public service employment provisions. It focuses on training. It's also performance-driven. The law requires a reduction in welfare dependency and an increase in earnings for those who participate in the program. And there's a fairly involved statistical procedure for doing that measuring that the Department of Labor has established. But the law is performance-driven, and there are standards that have to be met if your local picks are to receive the dollars. The trick in all this is that the state is liable for the dollars that come into it. And then if you have problems on the local level, you as state officials then assume some sort of liability for what happens. So if there's no other reason why a legislature might be interested in the Job Training Partnership Act, it simply comes about because of that liability.
Right, can I just ask you a question? In other words, if a PIC, and this is a very decentralized system, if a PIC spends money in violation of federal law and it later is audited, is the state of Oregon liable for that money? Because the feds come after the state.
Mm-hmm. Our understanding is that the federal government will only come after the governor on that issue. And the governor will then have to deal with the local officials. For that reason, the PIC members in several states are becoming interested because they're aware that in dealing with the state, for not only the liability issue,
but if there is, I can't remember the technical term when you have a federal grant program where the feds have determined that the money has not been spent appropriately, they usually want the money back.
Correct.
And since they would require the state of Oregon to come up with money.
That's one possibility. Part of the problem in all this is that the federal government has not given states clear expenditure or audit guidelines. They've been exempt from the standard procedures. And there's been a lot of hesitancy on the part of local officials, understandably so, in terms of how they spend the dollars. This is a complicated program to get up and running in 2 years. It takes time to educate local officials sitting on boards and on state boards about program issues and operations. I suspect that's one of the reasons that a lot of the money in a lot of states is in fact not being spent. Some of your states with your largest unemployment problems have high categories of money not being spent in these programs. That also gives the federal government another reason to suggest that they may want to cut the program because the dollars aren't being spent. But another thing you might want to do, and something I recommended right before I came here, I was in Lansing, Michigan with their labor committee in the House talking about JTPA, is find out the level of expenditure in your local district, in your PIC, or on the state level, and start to ask questions about state practices and procedures that may be inhibiting the expenditure of those dollars. State regulation can often tie up programs. It can often aid programs, as we'll get to in a few moments. But that's one of the things you may want to be aware of, is that expenditure. The other program that's gotten a lot of state and legislative involvement are the Title III dollars, dislocated worker programs that are dealt with on the state level. Now, states are using different strategies in terms of how they spend the state dollars that they in a sense control. And I'll use the term state, even though the federal law uses the term governor, because JTPA operates within state policies and procedures. So if your state has a large control over federal dollars coming into a state, if your state generally has legislators appoint members to governor's advisory panels, then these are areas where legislators automatically get involved in and have been across the country. Kentucky and North Carolina have a state constitution It says that the legislature cannot participate in advisory committees of the executive branch. Therefore, there are two of the four states in the country that don't have state legislators on the State Jobs Council. North Carolina has gotten around that problem by setting up a joint appropriations subcommittee to examine job training policy. North Carolina has the advantage of having the legislature having line item control over federal dollars that come into the state, and constitutionally a very weak executive branch. So they typically play a role in federal programs as such as they operate in the state. So one of the rules of thumb we use with legislatures is look at the Job Training Partnership Act as one of 200 odd grant and aid programs that come into your state. And rather than seeing as an independent structure, look at it as a tool that you can develop strategies around to do something with as you want to meet the needs that it's targeted for. It's largely free dollars. The matching requirements are very minor in the law and can be dealt with a lot of in-kind contributions through your UI system, your education programs. There are going to be a lot of ties between the new Federal Vocational Education Act coming into a state and the Job Training Partnership Act. The new federal act allows for kinds of commingling things in education to happen. You can't use JTPA dollars to supplant programs, but you can coordinate it with a lot of other programs. In Minnesota, there are other 40 state and aid education programs that can be combined in some way with job training. And one of the things the Minnesota program operators have done is put together a little chart of how do you take dollars from one area and combine them with another to achieve a given end. That's important because whether the fact you're dealing with unwed parents who are teenagers, older dislocated workers, the whole spectrum of people in need of jobs or skill training, be it basic skills or vocational, you're dealing with the same basically policy areas you as legislators have a role in, welfare policy, UI, education, the same areas. And one of the things that legislatures seem to be doing is reviewing those policies in terms of how do they put a flexible system together that can pick up and meet those needs. Something has to be done since the dollars are continually seem to be decreasing from the federal government. What I'd like to do is briefly go over a few laws that have been passed and haven't been passed around the country. There are other states have been looking at. We are trying to compile a set of these policies. Compiling state laws is not always an easy task. You tend to get a lot of questions when a law is being considered, but somehow when legislatures go out of session, it's tough to get a copy sent to your office. But one thing we do is keep a file of these, and we're putting together a legislator's guide on job training. So if you have any questions about any area, give me a buzz, and we'll see what we have on file that might be of assistance to you. Well, first of all, legislatures are doing what you have done in terms of setting up oversight committees during the interim. New Hampshire has formed a select committee very similar to yours, with members of welfare, education, and labor examining the policy for that state. Kentucky has a large monitoring operation on the go. North Carolina has just set up a similar procedure through their joint government operations committee. Other states are beginning to pass implementing legislation on the Job Training Partnership Act. And that's fairly mild legislation that basically says, we support the goals of the Job Training Partnership Act in our state, and we feel that there's a role for the legislature, and we want to be kept informed. And so they ask certain things. They'll ask for representation and write it into law on the State Job Training Coordinating Council. They'll ask to receive copies of the State Job Council plans, something not required by the federal law, but something which over half the states are receiving. They'll make sure that the PIC meetings are open to review from citizens in the local PIC. They'll make sure that they get copies of the PIC plans. They'll also deal with certain questions of conflict of interest that can occur on the local level, with PIC members also potentially being eligible to receive government dollars for training programs. It's an issue that's been raised in a few states. It hasn't been dealt with on the federal level in audit procedures, but it's happening. But I'm going to leave with staff a copy of the Illinois and Indiana laws for implementing legislation. New Jersey wrote their own program for job training modeled on JTPA. Texas has set up a fairly active JTPA review. They wrote implementing legislation when the law was set up. They capped the size of the council to no more than, I think it's 40 members. I think the largest state council is New York with 56. New York, by the way, has 6 members of the legislature on their council, and those members are chosen by the houses of the legislature, 3 from the Senate, 3 from the House. The governor has no say in the legislatures that sit on his advisory council. Washington had a law that was defeated, but I included it. Not all job training legislation proposed passed. But it has some ideas in terms of the way you can array things in terms of legislation that may be of interest. Maryland has a law in the books that's been copied by several other states on implementing legislation. They even set up a Department of Labor to handle job training programs in the state. But in their preamble to their law, they come out and state that it is a state policy to coordinate all the resources available from federal, state, and local governments, business, labor, community, etc., to foster, promote cost-effective employment and training system. An idea that's starting to emerge in legislators around the country, looking at your welfare programs, your UI again, your employment service in terms of putting together a system. Well, Maryland decided that they liked the way the program was operating in the state. So they then turned around and put in $2 million of monies for support service costs, for paying transportation costs to get people to local training centers, to pay for child care issues, to pay for stipends to keep people in programs. The more you target a program toward the economically disadvantaged, the hardcore unemployed, the more you're going to find the need for support services to keep them in programs. And Maryland's decided to put that direction on their program. Maine had another law that passed. In Delaware, they tried to set up an oversight committee and it was defeated, but I brought a copy of the resolution along anyway. Wisconsin didn't put any money to start off of their own into the program, but since in Wisconsin they control federal dollars in the legislature, they decided that 50% of the 8% set aside for education is to be spent on out-of-school youth. It's just a one-line item in the appropriations bill that went through. And I understand now that Wisconsin has set up some very good programs in terms of providing assistance to out-of-school youth. JTPA is a fairly innovative law in that you can start moving in at age 14 with remedial programs and doing a lot with your education system. An area of the law, by the way, that hasn't really been caught on to by a lot of states. It's one of the slower areas to take effect. And
Senator Otto?
You made the comment about the state of Wisconsin having a very good program. Well, obviously, you have evaluated the programs in the various states. How does Oregon stack up?
In terms of program operation?
Yes.
As far as I'm concerned, it seems to be operating as well as with any of the other programs in the country. I haven't spent a lot of time on program operation. I deal mainly with the legislative side of how you develop a strategy to have something happen. With reference to the report that the interim committee issued, the issues raised with the program in the report are probably generic to every JTPA operation in the country and in every state. Short-term training versus long-term training. When you have a performance standard-based program, it's easier to perform if you develop short-term programs rather than long-term programs. And that happens in any job situation you're in, where you have those kind of standards. You tend to cluster your activities toward meeting the standards. And that's what the federal law tends to do. It's a major criticism of it, that there's not enough chance to invest in long-term training given the way the performance standards have been developed. As respect to business subsidies, it's a common question in training programs. Do you subsidize business? Do you subsidize the individual? What's the outcome? And you could go over every issue that was raised in the report. I've met your people at conferences. I listen to them speak. I consider them, you know, operating with a high level of sophistication as individuals in their programs. So without having sit down and read all the I just got a copy of the annual report for the program. I haven't read it yet. but without sitting down and going through the actual plans and how they're written. Those are my comments from what I've seen from Oregon. The question I suspect you have as a legislature is, to what degree do you want to impact on the program? And that's something that I can give you advice as what other states and do areas, but I cannot really answer for you. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Okay. As for other areas, California just took $5 million of their federal social services block grant and put it into JQPA programs. California has been more actively involved than any other legislature in the program. They wrote something called the Family Economic Security Act, where they basically reviewed, all their state policies with respect to welfare, unemployment compensation, and made a regulatory review, looking for areas that they could open up programs so that they could, so local operators could start putting pieces together to provide services for individuals. In Pennsylvania, I understand they haven't written any job training legislation, but they passed a bonds issue for equipment for vocational technical institutes in the state. I think it's around $24 to $27 million of new monies for equipment for training programs. But what they required was that the local PIC sign off on those training programs before the schools receive the money. So all of a sudden the PIC is taking on a new role in the state, even though it isn't necessarily authorized in state policy. There's a firm belief that the PIC, with its private sector involvement, could best decide how some of those programs were to operate. Another area is the whole area of employment and training emerging on the state level that has nothing to do with JTPA or complements JTPA. California and Delaware both reformed their UI funding formulas to allow for separate programs to be set up. California is best known with its employment and training panel, which is basically a preventive policy on plant closings as opposed to remedial policy, which most of JTPA is. Illinois created the Prairie State 2000 Fund, which is a voucher training program. It's just been set up and got going, but it's the first time I've heard vouchers used in this area of employment and training. And that was part of their whole economic development package.
Rod, could I ask you a question?
Yes.
You're saying in California, then, they are able to marshal their unemployment, part of their unemployment fund for their dislocated workers as part of their plant closure legislation. In other words, when an industry would notify them that they're going to have a layoff, then they can move in ahead of time to start retraining the workers.
They have mechanisms to move in. What they did was they had a surplus in UI. They're one of the few states that had that problem. It's a problem. It's a nice problem to have. And so they went to the business community and said, well, lower your taxes, but let's take part of that percentage and set up a private fund. And what they did was they created an employment and training panel. And what they do in their employment and training panel is they get a group of citizens to sit on the board, they create a lobbying force for it, and they start to identify individuals who, where plants are going to be closed and needed training, and they move in. Very similar to what the United Auto Workers did in Ford have done with their negotiations. Job security is suddenly translated into retraining in the automobile industry. And when I was in Michigan earlier this week, I went down to Dearborn, and I met with some of the people putting the program together. It's interesting to see the parallels in this program with JTPA. The training has to be determined on the local level, and the national union leadership will proceed to provide funds and do all sorts of things to allow those kind of things to happen on the local level. Very similar to the state and federal role in JTPA. But they are having basically a union a week from around the country come through their training headquarters asking for information, because it appears that the wave of the future in union negotiations may in fact be providing some sort of retraining fund, especially in your high labor-intensive manufacturing industries. Now what all this means is that a lot of money, $50 million a year is my understanding in the United, with the United Auto Workers, is being dumped into retraining purposes independent of your basic education system and oversight of those funds from government. Whether or not that's important, I don't know, but it's a lot of money.
Are you saying the UAW program is in some way connected with the Job Training Partnership Program, or it's a separate program?
It's separate. It has an analogous structure in that decisions are to be made on the local level in terms of training. They do, in fact, receive JTPA dollars in their training centers, and they receive a lot of, in the state of Michigan, Title III dollars, dislocated worker monies. They get their money from a series of places, not only from what's known as the Nickel Fund in their negotiations.
Senator Otto.
When you talk about the auto workers and their retraining program, are they retraining for those workers to go back into the automobile industry or to take a job elsewhere?
Both. What's interesting to me is you have a union now training people to go outside their union.
Yeah.
They will send you to college, they will send you to law school, and they have a series of programs available for that. But, you know, they do not necessarily specify that you have to go back into the auto industry.
But part of it is to go back into the automobile.
Yeah. In the robotics industries is a case in point in Michigan where those jobs open. They also have centers in operation in California and Alabama.
Yes, I'm saying that those are accurate figures for the first 6 months of the year. Those are what the placement rate for adults were in each SDA. That was information that Senator Hendrickson had requested from our office.
I wanted to, if I could, Senator Starkovich, one of the problem areas, at least I think it's a problem, is that there's not a uniform standard with respect to retention in the program. And what we were trying to, we were hoping, but I guess there's just mechanically not a way to get that information, is that you do have to, for some funding aspects, have figures on 30-day retention, and we were hoping that you could match those figures up with the general program figures so that we have some idea of how many of these people are staying on the job for at least 30 days. That information, as I understand, is not, you don't have the programming capability to do that at this point.
And that is correct. We did have from two of our service delivery areas information about the numbers of people that they contacted, and we did provide that on that green sheet. It does show for two of the SDAs, the number, the first number is the number of people that they were able to contact, and the second number is the number of people who were still employed. And we can identify that roughly 85% of the people were still employed at the end of 30 days. However, we don't know really what that means. How does that relate to the general population and the general workforce? And one of the things that I've provided you, and I think it's in the yellow category, is an overview that we presented to the emergency board just for their information about what kind of follow-up system we will be having at the state level to look at this issue, because it's an issue that is concerning both local private industry councils and the state council. And certainly the interim task force and this committee have been interested in that also. And we have been working with the Employment Division to access their UI files to be able to look, when a person leaves a program, we'll be able to look at them in an aggregate, SDA by SDA and also statewide, for a two-year period to track that. And I think a key ingredient to this strategy is also to look at a control group so that we can look at how does the general population, how much do they move around in jobs, how long do they keep jobs versus those people who have been trained through the job training program. And as far as our staff knows, we have not been able to access any national studies that would give us that information, so we feel that it's real important that we do it. We anticipate starting this process in July of this year, and we don't anticipate probably getting any kind of data until probably January of 86.
Could I just ask a question on what is the purpose again of getting the UI information? Because some of these people will have exhausted their benefits and won't be going back into the system.
This will be using the employer files that every employer reports how many people on their payroll is working and how many hours. We'll be using that through Social Security numbers to find out whether the people that were in the job training program are still employed or whether they're not employed, and we'll be able to do that on a quarterly basis.
Okay, but what I'm trying to say is the whole universe of people you have in the job training program are not going to be in that system. You're going to get partial figures, right?
We will get partial figures. I think that it it's still the biggest sample size that we can pull from. I mean, there are certain people who don't pay, who are not involved in the unemployment compensation system, but it's a very small percentage of the total workforce in Oregon.
I see. So once they are placed, you'll track them through that
mechanism.
Right.
Yeah.
The other thing, I would certainly hope that you would look into, I know you're saying the feds don't require you to keep statistics on the single families.
Mm-hmm.
I would hope that the state would break down those that aggregate data so we can know how many people with preschool children are being served in this program. Now that you're doing it, entering into a new, if you're developing a new data system, is it possible you can get that data for us?
It's a lot more complex than just saying that you need to have the data, because we don't collect the ages of children in the database now, which means that everyone would have to go back and calculate.
Well, Holly, I thought you said the feds required you to keep a breakdown by ages 0 to 3 and then 3 to 17, so you are collecting that data.
We're just collecting that is if they have children in that category or if they don't. So
all I'm saying is, in addition, you put another block on so that you break down that. You know, I'll just keep harping on that. That 3 to 17 is worthless.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to get a further breakdown because you have no idea within that age range which of the participants require child care. And,
mm-hmm.
and that, I don't understand, well, maybe I do understand why the feds want to have the data broken down
mm-hmm.
that way, but because it masks the need for child care or who's being served. And
I think locally that local people can ascertain that by going through their files. And
well, I'm saying for the state legislature.
Yeah.
I think we have a right to know that information.
Okay.
We've been hearing the fact other states are marshaling their resources, are seeing who's being served, who has needs, and how can we, you know, we're the state policymaking
mm-hmm.
body, and how, when we don't even get data, how can we know even the extent of what the program is doing?
You know, as I pointed out to the interim committee, I think we have a real problem in terms of we have been cut over 25% in terms of administrative dollars. We have an information system that is 3 or 4 times as extensive as what the national model is, so that the legislature and the state council and local private industry councils will have data in which to make decisions. And I think that really what it comes down to is a situation where if we change the data system and we start collecting additional data that it's not directly related to job training, how are we going to pay for that?
Well, is it that hard when you're already asking 3 to 17 that you could make a cutoff 3 to 6, one more block?
We'll research it for you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Hamby?
Holly, my comment is in a similar vein, especially with the costs of running the program, administrative costs, et cetera. And please don't take my comments personally, because I'm highly critical of any agency of state government, whether it's funded with federal dollars, state dollars, or local, that puts out such a slick, beautiful brochure. I can't tell you how offended I was. I'd love to know the cost of your first annual report for the first 9 months. The glossy paper, the silver, everything.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a shame that those dollars can't go directly to help the people that the program's trying to serve.
I think that, to respond to your question, the annual report is paid for out of the 5% administrative funds.
Mm-hmm.
And we do contribute almost $100,000 of our administrative money to go back to the local service delivery areas, because at this point in time we have more funds in terms of the administration than is necessary to administer the program.
I must share with you, I don't care whether the report is coming off of the New York Stock Exchange or what have you, but it is most offensive when I see dollars that should be going to serve the public used in fancy reports.
Okay. In terms of additional funding, in terms of special targets, and I want to end in 3 minutes because I know you have some other people who wish to speak. There is 22% of the money that is to be set aside for special targeting of certain groups. This includes the 8% state education coordination and grants. It includes 3% for training programs for older workers. It includes 6% for incentive grants and 5% for state administration. We are currently using the 6% incentive grants. We set aside approximately 80% of that for incentive grants over the transition year. We've set another 80% aside for incentive grants for this year for those service delivery areas who meet or exceed the performance standards, both for adult and for youth. We've kept 20% aside for those service delivery areas who do not meet the performance standards and who are determined to need additional technical assistance. The 3% older workers funds are going to service delivery areas to serve additional older workers in their programs on a fixed unit fee contract. And the 8% funds go to the Department of Education and are governed by an agreement that is agreed to by our agency and the Department of Education. Those funds currently target three specific groups. One is state initiatives for youth program that we are involved in with the Public-Private Ventures Foundation of Philadelphia. They have assisted us. We're one of three national demonstration projects that that have been targeted for these funds, and we've set up four demonstration projects in the state. I think one of your other persons who's going to speak today, Commissioner Barbara Ross, is the chairperson of the Youth Coordinating Council, who oversees those funds and has worked extensively in trying to see some new and innovative kinds of things happening between the job training system and the education system for disadvantaged or high-risk youth. There is another group of funds within the 8% that we use to try to coordinate education and JTPA at the local level, and that has been done in conjunction with the community colleges, the educational service districts, the secondary schools, and the JTPA programs. And then there's a small amount set aside for special economic development proposals of new businesses coming into the state who need training. I think at this point I'm going to end. I know that you probably have some additional questions.
I just have one very, very brief one, and I don't want to take up much time because we want to get our out-of-town witnesses on. But in the document that Rod gave us, he indicates in other states, or at least the Congress anticipate that 22% could be kept by the state council. And one of the functions that the money is kept for is auditing. Now, if all the money is passed through, how do you perform the functions of auditing or any other kind of review of what the local SDA people are doing?
One-third of my professional staff is considered the risk management team, and I think I need to give a little bit of background because our state is the only state in the union whose attorney general has determined that the way the law is written, the liability that the governor incurs is in violation of a constitutional requirement of the Oregon Constitution. It constitutes the potential debt of all the funds that come into the state. So in order to receive the funds, number one, we have had to get a liability insurance policy that covers errors and omissions for the entire state, and approximately $75,000 of general fund money is going into securing that policy on an annual basis. Obviously, given that kind of requirement, our state office is very concerned about how we manage the risks in the program, and we have set up sort of three things that I think are important to recognize. We have our risk management team that is made up of three of my professional staff people who go out on an annual basis and do a very thorough review of the entire operation of the organization. I think if you talk to some of the private industry councils and some of the state staff, they might say that we're almost more thorough than auditors are, because all of my staff have been involved in program operations, and it's not too easy to pull a fast one on them. And we do a very thorough analysis. We look at things like the concern about PIC, conflict of interest, and we go through every single minutes of all of the private industry council meetings to make sure that the law has been carried out by that individual program. In addition, the law allows a waiver provision to the governor, and we have passed this through to the service delivery areas, if they meet four criteria. There must be good procurement systems for giving out the funds in the first place. There must be a good contracting system in place. The local service deliverers must have a monitoring system, and if they find something occurs, they have to take prompt corrective action. This allows a system if there is a clerical error, for instance, in adding up the income, and we find out that the person's really over income, that if we can show to the federal government that the system was in place and that it was a good system and that we were checking it all the time and that this was just an out of the ordinary kind of circumstance, that we do not have to pay that money back. And so we have to do that at the state level, and the local service delivery areas have to do that to their, with their service providers in order to protect both levels of government. And then thirdly, we require annual audits, which is more frequent than what the federal law requires, of each service delivery area, as well as an audit at the state level by the Secretary of State's office. And we also, if we feel that there is a significant problem in any a contractor, we can call for special audits if we need to. So that is the way we have handled that particular situation. I think you need to know that under CETA in this state, we had like 0.2% disallowed costs when we got all done with the whole thing. So we're not a state that had significant problems, and I think that everyone who's involved in the program is very aware of the fact that with the liability insurance and the concern of debt, that we run programs that are risk-free.
Wow. It'd be interesting to find a program that's risk-free. Thank you. I'm going to open the public hearings now on Senate Bills 266 from 273. Commissioners, do you want to come forward together and present your testimony? I have two people signed up to testify. Thank you, Holly. We'll probably be asking you to come back again. I don't mean to cut you off, but we've got out-of-town people here, so. And I'm sure we're going to have you back in front of the committee as we continue to work on this issue. Good morning.
Hi. I'm Barbara Ross, Commissioner from Benton County. Thank you for letting us come into and making space in your program for us. I've got written testimony of a general nature, but what I'd like to do to save your time and to really focus this is to talk about Senate Bill 269. And I want to say the very first that I am very concerned about child care. I've had a long interest and concern in child care, and would heartily...
That's what I know, Barbara, and I was a little concerned about seeing you testify against all the bills to provide child care to our people out there.
Okay. The difficulty that I have is I'm afraid this isn't going to accomplish the purpose that you hope it will. Let me explain my fears to you about this so that you can, as you work on this, address those. What you're saying here is that anybody that's participating in JTPA would be eligible for child care programs administered by Adult and Family Service Division if funds are not available through JTPA. The problem that I fear that this will create is that we will spend the first half of the year expending JTPA funds and the second half of the year trying to use child care from AFS. And that we will destroy really what we've had now is the cooperative relationship that we have been able to develop with AFS in our own areas so that we can use the child care resource that is most appropriate for a particular case in considering somebody's eligibility. As you know, traditionally, AFS, because of their problems and their funding difficulty, has been really restrictive and at times punitive in their regulations. And so if you have to use JTPA regulations the first half of the year and AFS regulations the second half of the year when JTPA funds are gone, then you've got a really confusing situation. The other problem is that these support funds don't only go for child care. They are currently used, as Holly mentioned, for transportation, for other support services like uniforms and equipment people need, for housing assistance, for medical care, and for work experience. And work experience is something that we use for some of those that are the very most hard to serve and people who've been out of the labor force for a period of time. It is where we use our funds to pay the employer to provide a work experience for that person. And it is one of the few doors that we have open for some of the people who we have the most difficult time saying to the employer that this person can be a good employee. So I would just urge you, as you work on this bill, to be sure that it is, in fact, going to provide more child care, that it is, in fact, going to make support services more available and doesn't actually reduce flexibility and make less support services available to single parents. I think the only other thing I'd like to say is that in our own area, in District 4, which is a piece of the Oregon Consortium, we do have a really good coordination between our local social service funds and JTPA. We use part of our revenue sharing to support child care services directly in our own community. We have information referral in the same office with our JTPA program, and we access other local funds to provide other support. Uh-huh. And it's never enough, and this program doesn't serve all the people that need serving. But I am concerned that while I share your objective, I'm not sure this piece of legislation is going to do what you hope it will do.
Can I ask a question? You were also signed up to testify against 273, and 273 simply prohibits the Dalton Family Services Division from limiting the time a recipient may be enrolled in a federally sponsored job training.
Okay, what I'd like to say about 273 is you may need that in Portland or Multnomah County or someplace else. We do not currently need it now in our area. We have developed a cooperative relationship with our local AFS that we are pleased with, but it has been sort of from the ground up. The local people got together, real good client focus, and then got permission from the state to provide waivers. We are not having problems with that at our level. What I would be concerned about is if we do enact this kind of legislation, that you again make adult and family services more defensive and they find other ways to protect their system and their program. Now, all I can say though about where it's not needed is this is not needed in our own area.
Okay, of course we have to look at it at a statewide perspective.
And that's exactly why I make that point, is that there may be continuing problems in other areas that I can't address.
Could I just ask you one other question, and that is, do you keep statistics in your area about single parents who are receiving your services? You break down the categories three to seven.
And I happen to have those for you.
Thank you.
Right here. From July 84 through...
So it isn't that big a deal to keep those statistics, huh?
Well, I don't have them right here in my hand about the ages 3 to 6, but I could get those for you short period of time because I could get them. What we have here is confirmation that we, out of 1,200 people served... 386 are single heads of households, and I happen to know that a large majority of those are women.
Do you don't know the age of the children?
I do not know, but I can get that for you.
Okay.
I can.
That
get,
would be very helpful.
Yeah, I can get that for our district, and it is my belief that we are not turning people away from training because of lack of child care, but we have a strong commitment to providing that child care and getting it from some source.
Well, I can tell you it varies greatly. We had someone from Clackamas County that, I can't remember the exact figures, but I asked them the same figures, and there were very few people apparently that had small children that were able to get in the program, and there was very little child care available.
Well, I'll tell you where we have an additional problem, though, and this is everywhere, is that when they have gone through 3, 6, or 9 months of training, and they're off on their own, there is not the wages that they get, although they may be better than minimum wage, are not enough to pay private child care wages, and there's an additional need for ongoing subsidy for low-income slots subsidized in order to make that possible for them to continue employment, and that is a severe problem everywhere.
Thank you. Mr. Beebe, welcome.
Yes, Senator Hendrickson and members of the committee, I'm Jack Beebe, a Coos County Commissioner and a member of the Board of Directors of the Oregon Consortium that administers the Partnership Act in 27 counties, the same as Barbara is. I want to thank you for letting me come, but I don't want to waste too much time telling you how glad I am. I want to get on to the important things. The things that I'm going to be discussing are other bills other than what Barbara brought up, and one of them is the legislation. I also have written material that I'll give you later.
Thank you. We also have your letter to the committee.
Okay. the bills, Senate Bill 267 is one that I am very opposed to because it's, as the old saying goes, when something ain't fixed, ain't broke, don't fix it. And we have had very good success at the Oregon Consortium, which covers, if you look at the chart that Holly had up there earlier, a big share of the state. And we have had good success with the program where it's working, and it would be very expensive and a very costly and time-consuming thing, in my opinion, to change that over now into some other area and try to restart all over again. That is not conducive to keeping the system working well and getting people back to work, which is the primary purpose of the Act. If you would read Section 2 of the Act, it says the purpose of this Act to establish programs to prepare youth and unskilled adults for entry into the labor force and to afford job training to those economically disadvantaged and other individuals facing serious barriers to employment who are in special need of such training to obtain productive employment. Section 144 states each job training plan shall provide employment and training opportunities to those who can benefit from and who are most in need of, and keep that in mind, most in need of such opportunities, and shall make effort to provide equitable services among substantial segments of the eligible population. Part of the legislation that you're proposing is to go further than what the Act says and earmark certain segments of this. And I have a concern in that because at this point in time, nobody has told me what you're going to put in those little blanks as far as the percentages. And that could be as much as 80% somewhere, as far as I know. Nobody has said to me what you're suggesting to fill those blanks in this. Makes me very nervous. And the reason it makes me
nervous... We're willing to take suggestions.
That's right. And the reason for that, and I'll give you a very good example, because of the shortness of time, I won't go on.
Well, I think we may be able to go beyond a little. Senator Starkovich has indicated the caucus may not be being held at 10.
So one of the very good examples of why that is not good is because in Coos County, where I come from, as you all know, it's probably been publicized fairly well, that we are trying to get some of the module manufacturing for the North Shore Oil Project.
I had thought there were some problems down there, too. Someone came in, there's a problem up in Astoria they had with those with... How is it going down there?
Well, it's looking very tedious and very... very difficult, but it does appear that we will be able to get some of that. And if that should happen, we have also, as you well know, had several mills shut down in our areas, and we've got a lot of unemployed people. It's 17% at this point in Coos County and 20% in Curry, which makes up our district. We would like to have the flexibility to be able to throw every dollar that we can get our hands on into retraining those mill workers and other people to be welders and whatever it takes to do the job on those projects, plus update those welders who are already there and may need extra training. If we have earmarked in all of these different segments so many dollars that says we can't touch that, we lose the flexibility of taking all those dollars and throwing it where it's needed. And I think the worry is unjust or unneeded because unfounded, because we are addressing all of those things. The Act itself requires that we look at those. It's just that we need to be able to have the flexibility to throw the money where it's needed the most. And if you earmark it, that money can't be spent. And that brings me back to what the gentleman said earlier, and I'm sorry I forgot his name, but from the federal government area.
He's with the National State Legislators Association,
right.
Not the federal government.
Okay, it's National Legislators.
His job is to help state legislatures around the country deal with these issues.
And I think that you have a very unique situation at this point in time because you are...
Which I might say is a nonpartisan office.
That doesn't matter. I'm a good Democrat. And
well, we like to hear this, too. At least it cheered him.
The point I was making in it is that he stated that in some states they're having monies that can't even be spent and having problems. I propose to you that part of the reason for that is that too many times the state makes too cumbersome and he alluded to that himself, too cumbersome of laws and regulations, and goes even further than what the Act says and gets into putting too many of these new bills and new regulations on. And in some cases, that has created a situation where people are so edgy because of all of the rules and regulations that they've got to meet, which sometimes don't even agree with each other, that they fear spending the money, and so they don't. And I would say that you have to be very careful in your unique position as having the right by the Act to control this, that you don't get into that situation. And that's some of the concern that I'm here today for, is to caution you that some of these bills would do just that.
Mm-hmm. And, Senator Otto?
Obviously, you two people up here have been involved in the front lines of this
yes.
program. You're probably aware of all of the bills we have on our agenda, 266 to 273 inclusive. Are you supportive of any of those bills?
The ones that I'm specifically opposed to are 269, 270, 272, and 273. And 270 and 272, the reasoning is just for what Jack just said, okay. that it limits the flexibility. And whereas you say you
and
have
the question was, are you supportive of any of the bills?
I think the one about the ethics one is fine. I'm in favor of ethics.
And what about letting the legislative... That's good to know. What about letting the legislative majority control who serves on the council rather than having the governor determine which member of the legislature serves
okay.
on?
Our council had a really rough start because of the turf battles and because of the everybody knowing they have to face audits and the financial problems that each agency faces. I think we've come a long way in getting people to work together, and we have been able to modify administrative procedures to increase coordination. I hate to break it up at this time. I really think that we have made progress in improving coordination, and I don't see...
Well, do you think the legislature should have a right to determine which of their membership should serve on that council?
Which of the legislative membership?
Yes.
I don't have any objection.
That's what the Bill 266 is about in addition
okay.
to the
other. I don't have any objection to the legislature saying who from the legislature is going to serve. I think that one...
That's what the main thrust of 266 is. Right now the governor determines, not the legislature.
But who from the legislature?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. I don't have any objection to that.
But it also goes further than that, does it not?
Well, it places... The Commissioner of Labor was not on the council until...